Alejandro González Iñárritu's Birdman, starring Michael Keaton, is nominated for 9 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Writing, and Best Cinematography. The following conversation with writer-director Iñárritu and cinematographer Emmanuel Lubezki was recorded in front of a live audience following a screening of the film.
Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome the Academy Award-winning cinematographer Emmanuel Lubezki. And you know him, you love him. He actually showed up today, ladies and gentlemen. Alejandro González Iñárritu.
You don't want to be touched, or anyway.
Yeah, not by you. Thanks for bothering. Thanks for showing up today, by the way. Yeah,
nobody likes Mexicans. I know that. I know.
Okay.
Yeah, this is just a red state kind of a room. let me ask you this. What was your first conversation with Chivo about the film? What was that first talk?
How much you going to charge me? And I couldn't afford it. No. Chivo, do you remember? I think he will remember.
I remember. One of our first conversations was you call and you said, Chivo, you know, I have this idea. I want to do this movie, and I think I want to do it in one shot. I'm not sure if it's possible. And at that moment, my brain just kind of switched off, and he kept talking for like an hour and a half. But I was only thinking, I hope he doesn't offer me this movie. I don't want to do it. And then he sent me the script. And when I read it, and then he talked about the movie, I felt very honored, and then we did the movie.
Why one shot?
It was conceived. I mean, in the moment that I knew that it was about the ego and some boys torturing a poor creature, I knew that it has to be told and not objectively, but in a way, I think it has to be a much more subjective experience to understand that voice coming from somebody inside you, in a way. So, I mean, not observing the character, but living through his mind. So, in a way, that one continuous shot from his point of view, because it's not only a one shot, so, I mean, because it can be a one shot that is very objective, but trying to get into his mind, it in a way it operates, or it was more like an extension of his state of mind, you know, that shift from reality to his own fears or delusional thoughts, and to really not only understand it or observe it, but to feel them, we have to be inside that. So I knew that that was the only way, you know, to do it.
And you start the movie off with that meteor. Where does that come from?
The
comet. The meteor that starts the movie.
Well, honestly, I have to say that came as we were shooting the film, because I always said that you plan for years, or you are in a way germinating an idea, and I think you become much more sensitive and attract more ideas when you are doing it actually, because suddenly that thing that it. A concept or a notion of things, when it become to take shape and actually began to exist as its own thing, it began to attract different things that you were not expected. And that was one of the things that I knew, that it needs something that implies something. What I didn't know is one of those unconscious things that is not irrational, but is kind of like a thought without a mind. I mean, And I saw some comets in some videos and some images, and I began to understand some things that I was feeling, but I was not being able to articulate in words in the scripts, or something that it was attached narratively. But in a way, for me, means when I saw that, I thought that comet was basically a way to say it without say it. the state of mind of this guy. He was on fire. He was inspired. He was feeling flying as a superhero, as a star. But the most interesting thing for me is when I discovered the jellyfish part, the dead jellyfish. That's exactly who this guy is. He is a guy who 1 hour he feels a comet on fire, and 30 minutes later he feels a dead jellyfish, and that's his life. And anyway, sorry, you don't look to me like that.
I was just resting my eyes. Don't worry about me. I guess I was wondering about that too, because given how most of the movie takes place inside a man-made structure, the first few shots were of nature, you know, between the comet and that seashore. And I just wonder if you thought that was a way also to set it up too, by going from these extremes that also suggests this weird kind of death and loneliness to taking us inside. I mean, that came to you too as you were shooting, just the idea of starting from the outside to going inside?
Something that Chiwo and I discussed, and I think in that sense Chiwo and I really got, you know, very close in conceptually things, and that's why I think it's easier to work with when you understand conceptually, and then you find yourself in the journey of explore what is that, but conceptually you know, right? We discuss a lot of time about that, not to not be only radically dictatorshiply Taliban-y, in one shot, right?
No, that's right. I mean, I remember when Alejandro found this image of the comet, he couldn't really articulate what it meant. He couldn't do it with words, but definitely he could, as he just did now, express that he finally had found this image that represent the character and the emotions of the character and so on. And we were trying to wonder, well, how do we integrate this in the movie? Is it valid to suddenly cut and chop the movie if we were trying to do this one shot? And we got to the conclusion that it actually was better to have these cuts and not try to do an Olympic one-shot deal to show off or anything like that. But these shots also could be part of the memory of this guy, of the internal state or so on. And so we didn't want them to, we didn't want to incorporate them in the one shot, but have them, you know, appear as cuts. And they do appear later when he blows his nose off, and you think he might be dead. This might be what he's thinking as he's dying or something like that. I love in Alejandro's work the ambiguity of all these images. And it's so funny because in America, with a lot of people get almost upset. Like, what is it? Why is that it's not explained? Why is that there's no subtitles?
Yeah, why is it not explained?
What is the ending? What does the ending mean? I cannot tell you how many people approach me to and say, can you explain? Is he dead? Is he not dead? Is he? And I just love these images that are almost a poetic approach to the storytelling that don't really explain but make you feel something. They create emotions. And I think that's almost more important than explaining and being too literal about certain things. I love that in his work.
But what you're talking about, that idea of the subjective, basically extends all your movies. They're all sort of inside somebody's state of being, aren't they?
Yeah, but I think that I think emotionally, hopefully, they transmit a little bit what the character.
But that's where you start, though, isn't it? That kind of using that kind of emotional, yeah, sort of visual to trigger something in audiences, isn't it?
Yes, but in a way, I think the form here of being inside or being without. I will say that honestly, the editing or the juxtaposition of time and space is an invention. It's an invention of our minds. Honestly, we are trapped in a continuous time. So time is actually differently from space, not a three-dimensional thing. Here we can go up, down, or light, right, left. Time is unidimensional. It's going only one direction. That's why we get old, we die, and we cannot go back to our youth or to visit 2,000 years before, because it's unidimensional. And I think fiction, literature, film, every art in a way is concept, in a way to get out of our unidimensional existence in times. And And that's why we love it. We are addicted, because when we are kids, we said, and then in the woods, blah, 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 and then cut to the... So we are imagining different realities because we can't escape ours. And in this case, that's why I think that the fact that suddenly the audience is in this continuous shot, living with this guy breathing and not blinking and not edited and not juxtaposed, I think that it has an emotional effect differently, and it gets the experience a little closer to what really our real lives are. And I thought that that was an interesting thing. And it could have been terrible, by the way. It could have been wrong in every sense, because in a way we are so used to be, in a way, comfortably taken to different places, and that we understand that. And that's what makes us feel comfortable, because we know that we are not living that. We can see war and people dying, but we are in our seats and saying, oh, that's unreal, and we separate from fiction by that. But in the moment that you are there, I think you leave things much more. And I thought that that was... you know, something to bet on. And I think it's interesting.
Were you attracted by the challenge of this, Chivo? The idea of doing this thing that was a daring thing?
Honestly, not. I wasn't. I was very worried.
Why were you worried?
I was worried because the tone of the movie in the script, you know, it's a comedy, and the rhythm of the movie in the script and so on. I wasn't sure if you could tell that story that way. I understood the importance of doing it this way in terms of how to express the emotion of the character and get the audience immersed in the movie and so. So I thought it was important, but I didn't want to go through it. I knew that it was going to be incredibly hard. And it takes an absolutely insane person like Alejandro to take a whole crew. And he's completely insane. And there's something weird. It's slightly naive, irresponsible, crazy.
You know he's right here, right?
No, I know. This is like a therapy. It's like a therapy, but that's what makes an artist an artist. And that's why, you know, I'm an engineer and he's an artist and he's a director. If I would have never gone through it. And many days I would say, Alejandro, please, let's just cut one more time. Why do you want to go through this? And you need somebody with the courage and the strength and the curiosity to go like, wow, where are we gonna go? To take all the crew and all the production and all the studio and all the actors that way. It's a very courageous, you say?
Courageous
a thing and very irresponsible. And that's why we, you know, I think he achieved something amazing.
I disagree. I think Chivo is lying in the, yeah. Also, I think if there's an artist in our generation, it's Chivo, I have to say.
I love you, Alejandro.
That's a real guy. That's a real guy. And I have to say that, in a way, I think many times when it was unsolvable, not only technical, but I think in a
it's
way
not
again,
technique.
No, it's not technique, but in a way, it's we have forgot. I think generally the cinema has been relying comfortably in a very artificial way that we accommodate the events to make everybody, you know, standardly connected or entertained or whatever. But we have stopped exploring possibilities, I think. I think the only director is out there still now is Godard, that every time that he does something, he just touch every note. And he failed many times. But when he hit it, it's just an amazing discovery of a guy who, as, you know, Schoenberg, or one of those musicians, he's discovering new notes or new harmonies or new ways to use the same chords. And there was a novel that when I was young, I read from an Argentina writer that is called Ernesto Sabato. And Sabato wrote a little short novel that is called El Túnel, The Tunnel. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing because it was that. It was basically written, no commas, no dots, and it was just like a stream of consciousness. And it was like, how this guy did that? And all the Latin American writers, most of them really play a lot with that. You know what I mean? Cortázar and Borges and all those guys. So I think in a way it comes from that culture of us to be playful with the form, which at the end it become content. It become part of what you are trying to say. And I think that's something that it has been lost in a way of, even if you see or...
Why do you think that is? Or why do you think it's lost?
Because nobody pays attention. Or nobody. I think everything is about the story or about the good ending, the commodity of it. It's like if it's entertaining, even if you see a lot of 99% of the reviews, when you see a review or some critic talking about visual grammar, they don't know even what is that or what means to put...
So some critics.
Some critics. That's what I'm saying, 99%, Mr. Elvis. So what I'm saying is that nobody talks about that. And I think that everything about cinema can be teach. You know, I think that to make a film is easy. To make a good film is all this war. To make a great film is a miracle, I have to say. You don't have nothing to do with that. But I have to say that it has to do with the fact of the things that you never learn or the things that you found in your way that are miraculously. And which has to do not with, okay, you know, everybody can understand how to make a film. It's very easy technically, blah, blah, that you can learn. Okay. The thing that nobody can teach you is those things, like that point of view of if you put the camera here or here, and that thing just changed the whole thing. And nobody can teach you that. Nobody, no, there is no school.
What I was going to say is also film is an industry and it has to produce a lot to keep moving and stuff. So it's easier to, you know, make everything in a pattern and do it fast and do it in a certain way. And so you need, again, I'm sorry to keep going that way, but you need people like Alejandro to, within the industry and within all the limitations and all this stuff, go to the side and try to manufacture something like this. It's really hard. I'm very lucky to you know, to meet people like him that within all this, yeah, this factory, you can still try to find a language that is slightly different and that gets the audience, you know, pulled into the movie in a different way and tell a story in a different way and so on. So that's very rewarding.
Because what you're talking about, and going even back to the tunnel, it's a piece about somebody who doesn't live in the present. And your movies are all, even a lot of stuff you shot about people who either looking back to the past or looking ahead to the future, they're not in the present. What is it that attracts you to those kinds of people?
Because I think it's very hard. I have been operating all my life. Sometimes I have I realized that I was spending much more time in the future or in the past than in the present, personally. I think all of us in a way do. So I mean, in a way we are always thinking that always the present is something that has to pass to go to the next moment. When you are in the next moment, you are thinking, okay, so... I think we have been taught like that, to be preventing things. What I'm gonna from what I'm gonna go do as a kid, what I'm gonna become when I'm an adult, to what, and I always what I said to the students of film. I said, you know, I said, well, do you think I will become? I said when they are directing their first short film or minute, whatever. I said, you are already a filmmaker. You don't become a filmmaker. You are. So I mean, you are because this is the only thing that will exist. Always this present. No, you know, you don't become nothing. you already are. And I have been learning that. But I think it's a very difficult thing to be present in the time, to be present, aware of really. It's really, we are not teach to be thinking like that, I think.
Because I don't know, you work that way too. A lot of them. You've been attracted to a lot of filmmakers who are working with people who can't live in the moment that they're in, and you must like that too, right?
I guess, yeah, and I cannot explain it to be honest, but I agree with Alejandro. We're taught to think about the future and think about the past. This is incredibly hard to
be in this moment. Sure. But one of the things I like about this movie too, and I've known you for a long time, it's your first comedy, and people would think you would walk, well, you guy who wore black all the time and and never smiled and suffered, and you run this guy. I mean, he's full of life, he's boisterous, he's really funny. There may be a little bit of a dark sense of humor there. I know it's hard to believe, but you are somebody who loves life, and this movie has a lot of that, and I wonder why it took you so long to get to this point as a filmmaker.
Well, I think that I think it has to be with my age. You know, I turned 51, I'm now 51, but in that time I was turning 50, which obviously hit me. And in a way, you know, tired of being approaching things. I have to say that the only way you can do films like the ones I did is you have to have a counterbalance. You cannot be just swallowed by that all the time because then it will be miserable. So, no, I think I think, in a way, intelligence is defined by the fact of having, or the possibility to have, two opposite ideas simultaneously and operate at the same time. I think we all are like that. And it doesn't mean that you are a happy person or a sad person. I think we are both at the same time. And that's what really, it's the human complexity of our brain. So I have both, as everybody, I guess, in extreme. And when I'm happy, I'm super happy. When I'm sad, I'm super sad. When I'm upset, I'm super upset. So I'm a little bit bipolar in that sense. But I have to say that the way I approach this film was, I think, a little bit differently, in a way, to survive. Not the facts of the film that are miserable and are common and are close to me, but in a way to in a way survive. The way we observe them, like more upside down, like, you know what I mean? I think you change your approach. I cannot change the fact that we are just this pathetic creature sometimes, but I can change the way I approach it and I see them. And I think I changed that. Not the fact. I think the film, in a way, can be very depressing, but it's the way I approach the film that was lightful and humorous.
Yeah, I mean, well, you go ahead.
No, and I think there's another thing that is that what I said before. Alejandro is very curious. He's almost like a little kid. So, I knew this was going to happen. You know,
he's
in a way, yes, because he's been doing something, but because I know him, and he's talking about all his interests and the movies that are that attract him, and not only movies but paintings and novels and travels and family, and you know that he's exploring and he's curious and he wants to try new things, and so I kind of knew he was going to try to do something different and also during the movie I could see it in the process, even though the movie was very planned and very, you know, we had a stage and we rehearsed every day he would come with new ideas, and you know, he was exploring the music and the images and the comets and the meteorites, and we would plan something, and you know, at 11 p.m. the phone rings and it's like, oh, what if the camera better goes this way and a ray of light, you know? So it's the constant exploration, I think, that also, you know, takes him to different travels and journeys and stuff. It's my guess.
When did you guys first meet?
Street bar. Alejandro was dancing.
Yeah, I was fired in that moment, and I became a filmmaker.
Didn't have enough singles for him. Is that
you
what
know?
It was?
The thing I remember is, again, one of those calls. Phone rings, and I was starting to shoot commercials in Mexico, and it's disguised with the voice. You know, how are you? This is Alejandro González Iñárritu. And I go like, oh yeah, I've heard this voice. He was a DJ in Mexico.
Yeah, Howard Stern in Mexico.
And he was really changing and modernizing the radio in Mexico, that before him it sounded like the 50s, you know. And so I know this voice, and you know, I want to shoot this commercial, and I would love to talk to you. I have some ideas. So I said, fine. So we meet. And he says, no, you know, it's one of my first commercials with this company and stuff, and I want this commercial to look like The Godfather. And again, it's this naivete of somebody saying, it's like if somebody says, yeah, I want you to paint something like Velázquez, you know, like Goya or something like that. Is the, for a DP, The Godfather is the top, the higher aspiration,
yes,
impossible to reach. You know? And fine, yeah, I mean, we can try. And
wait a second, what product was this for? I mean, you weren't selling Coca-Cola looking like The Godfather, right?
I don't even remember the product, but what I remember is that
it was for Father's Day.
Father's Day, like The Godfather.
Like The Godfather.
Ladies and gentlemen, Alejandro González.
Yeah. But anyway, what I remember the most is that the first day of shooting was 36 hours. And there were no drugs involved. It was just the energy of this guy.
He didn't nail it. It didn't look like The Godfather.
But it was the energy of this guy, you know, trying to do something that was like The Godfather and the actors and changing and experimenting and stuff. And at the end of this journey, 36 hours, I called Cuaron, this friend of ours that is a film director, and I said, Alfonso, fuck, I think I met somebody that is going to be a great director. This guy Iñárritu, and Alfonso was, oh no, my God, no, he's a DJ, forget it, he'll never direct a movie.
And he was right. But
he was right.
Why did you want to shoot a Father's Day spot to look like The Godfather? I can't wait to hear what this explanation was.
This was 20-something years ago. It was just like, you know, I loved that film, and it was kind of, I don't remember. It was like this, I did this commercial for corporate for this channel, and it was the luxury because I write it, and I produce it, direct it, and it was this two-minute-long kind of corporate things for a channel. So there was no product involved. It was just to sell an emotion. And it was this short, it was a discussion in a table of family reunion, and the father at the end say some truth. I mean, it was kind of a...
No, but you said the key. It was about getting a moment, an emotion,
exactly.
You know?
It was about that.
And that is the hardest thing. That's the funniest thing.
It was not selling nothing. It was just selling the family, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, we start like that. And from there, we start working sometimes in commercials. And then we did a short film together for the Cannes Film Festival that we did in one shot, by the way, here in a cinema in L.A. It's called Anna, and it's very beautiful. It was an homage to Godard and to the cinema. And then we did a couple of commercials around the world.
Oh my God! I saw you when you shooting in New York. You going around with that?
Yeah, we shot the commercial of Nike. That's called, what's the name? It was a very good commercial, like 4 years ago for the World Cup soccer, a big one with all these stars. So we traveled 2 months in Europe in the most. We bankrupt three companies. It was the biggest and disaster production. It cost more, like five times Amores Perros, I think, and. But anyway, we have had a very great experience in South Africa shooting commercials, but I never worked together, so it was a great opportunity to work in a feature, you know.
You know, but what happens when you work with a director, like I work with him throughout the years, is that you create this, like, it's like a frame of reference or a conceptual frame of reference that allows you to, you know, when you're experimenting and doing things like that, you don't have to explain too much. I kind of understand what he doesn't like or what. It's very hard to explain, but it's something that doesn't happen always. You know, it's very hard as a collaborator to enter into a movie with a director you don't know very well and be able to really serve or collaborate the way you can with a friend or with somebody that you've spent some time going crazy.
This makes me wonder, do you remember the last shot of this movie, the last thing you guys shot?
The last shot, you mean in terms of schedule?
Yeah.
I think the last stuff we shot was flying scene material, yeah.
And what was the first thing? What was the first day like in that theater? What was the first thing you guys shot?
No, the first day we shot... the video portion that you see in the first take of the movie, you know, when he's floating and the camera pans and goes to the computer, we shot that element, that part of with Emma.
Well, the first shot of the film was the one that Emma Stone in the flower that appeared in the computer,
and that was the first.
Exactly, we shot it with a telephone actually,
yeah.
And Emma was operating the phone, so that was the first in a flower thing, two blocks from the theater.
Exactly.
And then we went and we shoot that the floating scene, which the scary part was
Michael couldn't float.
That was scary.
That day he rehearsed every year, and then exactly, the tighty whities were too tight. But the thing is that the most scary thing, I don't know if you remember, it was the first thing, and it was a beat before that
yes.
You know, he was floating, and then there was a knock in the door, and then the camera pans, and there was the floor manager coming in and said, hey, we are waiting for you, blah, blah, and she made a joke, I don't know, a bad joke, like, a fart joke, kind of a very cheesy one, like one of that you find in classic bad comedies.
Like Birdman.
Exactly. And so the lady remembered, okay, boom, and it started, and I said, oh my God, this is a very bad, so it was cheap, right? It suddenly put the film in these jokes and I said, let me figure out how, so, because everything was planned so like a clock, every meticulous thing. So I think the camera do that. Michael came to the left door, and then we went like that. So it was like, it was a different mood. It was a different, completely movement. Instead of the way it is now, that he just stand up, boom, go sit lateral. They call it from a speaker, and then he goes like that. It was a completely different blocking and stage, and everything was. And it was terrifying for me, but because I stopped, I said, this doesn't work. I mean, it's horrible. So I have to change. I said, wait, I don't want this stage manager. How are we going to solve it? Okay, the sound. So we have to record that, put it in timing for Michael to react. And we have to, wait. So we are not here. So all the guys of the lights and all the fading and everything was absolute. But it was to change just one little camera angle. It's a huge thing. Because if it's not rehearsed, nobody really is in time.
No, it's like a ballet. It's like you've been rehearsing a ballet and you go like, oh, no, I want these 300 ballerinas to go like that with flags. And you go like, what? How do we do that? You know, it's a little bit like that. Yeah. Again, I'm going back to this thing that you need somebody like Alejandro to keep the crew going. Because in that moment, everybody panics.
No, I was panicked. I was panicked. So anyway, it was one of those examples of the first day of shooting that I said, oh my God, this will be very wrong. Because if I keep feeling this during the whole shooting, it will be impossible. Because then everything that we have done, it will collapse. We will never make it. So anyway.
When did you get past that feeling? When did you feel like you knew what the movie is going to be?
I never pass it. Even now, I'm nervous. No, literally, when I saw it in Venice, in the Venice Film Festival for the first time with an audience, honestly, I have never felt that in my life. I was in a panic attack. I was sweating my butt. Because not only I didn't know if the film worked or not, but when I was watching it, I didn't even understand how we did it. So, I mean, I was watching, said everything that could have been wrong. So it's almost like a miracle. Honestly, so, I mean, I really feel that, this is not something that I'm saying pretension. No, it really, as a filmmaker, and I think we talk about that many times, is all that could have been wrong is almost an infinite list of things. And when I was saying, I thought that something will go wrong and I didn't realize, and I feel panic still because it's as you said, it's very stupid. It's very irresponsible. I mean, it's
well, and on that note, let us thank the miraculous Emmanuel Lubezki and Alejandro González Iñárritu.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Elvis Mitchell in conversation with director Alejandro González Iñárritu and cinematographer Emmanuel Lubezki on their film Birdman. Subscribe to the Treatment podcast on iTunes and leave us a comment. We'd love to hear what you think. You can also find the Treatment on Facebook, where we post behind-the-scenes photos, videos, news, and more. Visit facebook.com/KCRW The Treatment and click like. This episode was recorded by Alex Fender and mixed by Melissa Morton. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW in Santa Monica.